Okay, thanks for coming. I think we're ready to get started now. The basic premise of this, and I hope we can have a really good discussion about water safety in general and our and what comes out of our tap, trouble at the tap here. It's kind of amazing if you think back just within a relatively short time of a little more than 2 years, the Elk River chemical spill in West Virginia, the Toledo water crisis. Obviously, everyone is very familiar with Flint's lead crisis, and here in California, people are very familiar with the prolonged drought that has occurred and how that impacts water quantity, water quality. So we've assembled what is a very impressive panel here. I think you're going to enjoy it. Joe Cotruvo, to my immediate left here. Joe was with the U.S. EPA during the early days. He was there when the Clean Water Act and the Safe Drinking Water Act were enacted in the early 1970s. He was the Water Division Chief at that time for the U.S. EPA and now is a jet-setting world-class consultant serving on the World Health Organization, and he's working on a consulting project at Berkeley now and so forth. We were fortunate enough to have him come by, and he has the added benefit of being a Toledo native. So, you know, as I said, who would have thought one of the world's top water experts is from Toledo. So, and speaking of world's top water experts, to his left is Peter Glick, who some of you may recognize. He's been to SEJ as a speaker. I believe this is his fourth time, Michigan State in 2000, and on a panel I had on desalination in 2005 and at the Miami conference in 2011. We like him. He's a good speaker and is co-founder of the Pacific Institute, which you know, don't worry about the name. He goes well beyond the Pacific and looks at the world's water stresses on has a real global view there. And to his left is Thomas Harder with UC Davis, who's a well-known groundwater expert. A lot of times we tend to hyper-focus on surface water and forget about all the groundwater that there and some of the challenges that that it faces. And to his left is Laurel Firestone, the co-director and attorney at law for the Community Water Center here in California, which God forbid, promotes the humanitarian right to water, among other things. So let me just turn and we'll start the presentations, turn it over to Joe, and we'll get started here.
Okay. Appreciate the opportunity. And I particularly because, you know, you are the gatekeepers for public information on health and environment. Most of what the public learns about health, environment, water, air, et cetera, they get from you. And so it's the government does a terrible job of communicating, and so it's really your burden, and I think it's something you should be very proud of and take very seriously because it's that's all they know is what they learn from you. So I'm going to start things off with giving a little background on the Safe Drinking Water Act, where it came from, what it did, does, successes, failures, and then I'm going to say a few words at the end about a couple of things that I think are sort of out of date, maybe need updating, maybe misinformation. I'll say a word or two about trihalomethanes, about Flint, and about Chrome 6. Well, Safe Drinking Water Act passed about 200 years after the country was formed. It was the first national legislation on drinking water, 1974. It came as kind of a shock to the water industry. The water industry was, you know, rather complacent, very localized. Each water facility basically self-contained, theoretically managed by states, overseen by states, with a great variety of levels of effort and quality. And so the water quality in the United States was covered quite a large range. And the water industry actually participated in the passage of the Safe Drinking Water Act. But once it passed, I think they had some misgivings because they all of a sudden you had this federal organization telling them what they should be doing, specifying water quality requirements, treatment and reporting, things that they didn't have much to do about before. They never reported, for example. And so at one point I heard people saying, well, you know, we did just fine for 200 years without the federal government being mixed into this. We don't really need you. Well, they really did need the federal government. It's come a very long way. It completely revolutionized the concept of water treatment in the United States. In the water technology that was being used in, let's say, 1975 was about the same as the water technology from 1920. The disinfection was introduced in 1907 in New Jersey. Filtration became fairly common in the teens and 20s, and then basically nothing happened from then on in terms of science, technology, performance. The Safe Drinking Water Act revolutionized all that, and today water industry people think of themselves as relatively high-tech. They do look at new technologies. They do introduce a lot of them, and in fact, they proudly do it, sometimes when they don't need it, but they proudly do it because they feel good. Safe Drinking Water Act passed in 1974. Believe it or not, it actually covers about 150,000 entities in the United States. About 50,000 of those are communities from 25 people up to New York City. And then there are about 100,000 of them that are sort of in between situations where you don't have resident populations, but you have facilities outside of water districts where they're providing water, and they are subject to certain elements of the Safe Drinking Water Act. So it's a huge enterprise, you might say. It's built as a pyramid. Federal government's at the top. Federal government is responsible for developing the water quality regulations, the reporting requirements, the monitoring. And one of the really novel aspects of the Safe Drinking Water Act is the kind of the self-incrimination, the self-enforcement aspect of it, and that is a public water supply is required to inform its citizens as to how well they've been doing their job. They report annually as to how many standards they didn't make this year, what issues they had with monitoring, et cetera, et cetera. So the intent of that is to make it kind of self-enforcing, to make it to provide the incentive for the water supplier to do a good job because they're going to have to report their failures. And if they're having failures, then the positive end of it is to encourage the community then to understand that there's need for improvement and need to invest more in the water system. So this is a very novel aspect in the Safe Drinking Water Act. Works pretty well. So there are currently about almost 100 standards. The regulations are of several types. They can be individual numbers, concentration values that should not be exceeded. And then there are also the opportunities to write what are called treatment requirements, where you can deal with a whole mass of substances by specifying a particular treatment. There are about 90 or so specific maximum contaminant levels now covering inorganic chemicals, organic chemicals, microbes. There are two major treatment requirements, one that requires filtration of surface water supplies, and another one that deals with disinfection of groundwater supplies where it's necessary. So although I said there are 90 substances regulated, there are actually, you could say, thousands, because all radionuclides are included by the way the standard is written. All pathogens are included, except for Legionella, and we'll talk about that, by the treatment requirements. So you don't have to go and monitor for typhoid or cholera or whatever. If you're meeting the treatment requirements, the water is safe. And then there are the disinfection byproduct regulations, trihalomethanes and HAAs, which some of you probably heard of. They provide a broad spectrum sort of ceiling on the amounts of disinfection byproducts that can be permitted in the water. So it's really quite comprehensive. What are the results? It's been very successful. Not perfect, but very successful. And by actual measurement, by number of waterborne disease outbreaks that have been identified. Since the implementation of safe drinking water, it's been a downward trend of numbers of waterborne disease outbreaks detected each year. It's down to about 6 per year now. And so 6 out of 150,000 locations isn't bad for government work. So so what are the concerns now? Historically and forever into the future, the major concerns of drinking water quality are microbial contamination, pathogen contamination of drinking water. Among the waterborne disease outbreaks, 2/3 of them are now legionellosis. And legionellosis was not required to be reported until 2001. So, in other words, the disease outbreaks that were reported before 2001 were way understatements. There were many, many, many more of these legionellosis-type cases that were occurring that were not recognized because there was no reporting. There was after 2001, and since then, the total numbers have gone down, but 2/3 of those that remain, about 22 per year, are relating to legionellosis, not from drinking the water, from inhaling aerosols. So, in terms of results, I think I'm probably getting to my 5 minutes. So I would say overall, these 150,000 entities are functioning, operating, reporting, virtually all meeting the regulations. There are always exceptions. We know that that can happen. The way the law is structured, federal government is at the top. The states have the what's called primary enforcement responsibility, all except Wyoming, which decided not to accept it, and D.C., which is not eligible because it's not a state. And then the public water supplies are required to do all this work and provide the safe water and notify the citizens. Now, what happened in Flint, by the way, was one of those cases where the system broke down, where the states who have essentially the first-level control responsibility to be sure that the water supply is doing the right thing didn't do it. Number one, the water supply didn't do the right thing. They didn't apply the appropriate treatment, which was really obvious, and that is corrosion control. They didn't do it. The state didn't require that they do it. And then apparently the state was actually misinforming EPA and the public as to what was going on. So when EPA got into it, ultimately, they were a little slow in responding. But I forgive them a little bit because they were getting misinformation from the state and because the state really has the legal responsibility to be doing all of this. So let's say a couple of things in the sort of the updating, maybe misconception thing. On Flint, what you have heard primarily is high lead, potential brain damage for the kids. There was high lead in the water. It was a totally unconscionable situation. Never should have happened. There was high lead in the water, but not very much high lead in the kids. And the simple reason is the water was so awful that nobody drank it. It was orange colored. It smelled bad. It was didn't taste very good. And no matter what people were telling, the states were saying, the state was saying, well, gee, it's safe. Nobody believed him. Nobody drank it. So the amount of blood lead increase was minuscule. And it was significantly less, by the way, than the average blood lead levels of everybody in the United States during the years of leaded gasoline. So that's just a point of perspective to appreciate. The real issue, I think, in Flint was Legionellosis, where several people died. There were two outbreaks, numbers of cases of Legionellosis, which is a pneumonia. And it still hasn't been absolutely established, but it is very plausible to have been linked. CDC is studying that now to make that determination. But that probably is the most significant health outcome of the Flint case. Another item, trihalomethanes. Trihalomethanes, disinfection byproducts, really the first modern drinking water regulations that were written in the 1970s. And everything after that has been modeled after the methodology that was used in producing the trihalomethanes regulations. Disinfection byproducts caused mostly by chlorine. Originally regulated because chloroform was identified as easily detected and also carcinogenic in animal test studies that were done in rats and mice. Subsequently, however, chloroform and the trihalomethanes are not carcinogens per se. However, they are appropriate to be regulated because they were regulated primarily with the concept of them being indicators that lead you to apply treatment that will reduce all of the disinfection byproducts in the water. So they are an excellent monitoring technique for managing treatment technology and requiring the introduction of treatment technology to reduce the exposure to all of the disinfection byproducts. But there is a kind of a misconception that they themselves are carcinogenic. They are not. It's been shown by subsequent research. Third item I was going to mention briefly is Chrome 6, which I know is a big issue in California and some other places. You know the history, Hinckley, Pacific Gas and Electric, contamination of groundwater. The question then became, is there a health risk? And there was a study, animal feeding study done by the National Toxicology Program, 2008, turned out to be carcinogenic in mice, particularly at the high doses, not at the low doses. And so based on that, state of California issued a regulation. Public health goal, rather stringent, very stringent public health goal, based on linear non-threshold carcinogenicity, meaning theoretically that there's a risk at any dose. Low dose, low risk. High dose, higher risk. Subsequent information has led Canada now to reassess the entire concept of the risk of ingestion of Chrome 6. They have not released it yet, but they are about to release their analysis. And they've concluded it is not a non-threshold carcinogen. It is a threshold carcinogen, which means there's a safe level below which there's no risk. And the number that they're probably going to pick is 50 micrograms per liter as their standard, their guideline. The California standard's 10. There's going to be a need for reassessment of the toxicology, which is normal. This happens all the time. There's always new data. So in that regard, those are three examples of situations that are perhaps somewhat in need of updating, some of them misunderstood. And so I'm sure we'll have an opportunity to talk, have some Q&As later, but just wanted to get you started with where the Safe Drinking Water Act started and where it got us. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. Why don't you go?
Okay. Thanks, Joe. You won't have any trouble hearing me. Good morning, everyone. I'm Peter Glick. I'm the co-founder and now president emeritus of the Pacific Institute in Oakland. I'm a hydrologist and climate scientist by training. I know some of you. Tom is much better, apparently, at keeping track of which of these conferences I've been to and which I haven't. But I've been at SEJ many times. It's one of my favorite conferences. And I'm a scientist, but my two siblings are journalists, so I'm the only one who's fallen far from the tree. And I have to say that we interact, the Institute's is a research and policy group. We interact with journalists all the time. Last year, We had 1,400 or so press hits during the year, coverage of our work. That's three or four a day. It was a pretty intense year. We do a lot of work on the California drought, which is obviously a big story, and it's still a big story, although the number of press people interested in it seems to have dropped off. Climate, we do work on conflict over water, a whole range of issues. In terms of the subject at hand, I'm going to talk very briefly about my sense of the big picture here, because the best part of this is the Q&A afterwards, and I don't really know what you're interested in. And so I just want to give you my perception about the big picture. All water stories fit into what we're talking about. Climate change is a water story. The conflict in Syria is a water story in part. Flint, Toledo, Elk River, and Charleston, West Virginia are obviously drinking water stories, but they're actually bigger than that. Chromium 6, the California drought. One of the things that makes water so interesting is it's tied to almost everything that we care about, to food, to climate, to our economic system, to public health. I know Laurel will talk about the human right to water in law. Water is a big story in a lot of different ways. And I really believe we're in a fundamental transition today from the way we dealt with water in the 20th century to the way I think we're going to have to deal with water in the 21st century. And Joe hinted at this a little bit. The 20th century saw some remarkable changes with water. 100 years ago, we started treating water. And he mentioned Jersey City. It's the first city in the United States that put in place a water treatment system around 1909, 1908. Filtration, some biological treatment. And when cities in the U.S. and Europe started to treat drinking water, we got rid of cholera and dysentery and typhoid. You look at the statistics, and the numbers of cases of cholera and all those water-related diseases that were very prevalent in the 1800s disappeared in the United States. It was really a remarkable change, and it was a technological change in large part. I would argue the institutional and legal pieces of those change took a little longer to catch up. And again, the Clean Water Act and the Safe Drinking Water Act didn't come in till the 1970s, the Cuyahoga River had to catch fire a dozen times. It took a while, but the institutional and management pieces of this started to catch up, and the technology has been changing over time. The 20th century was a remarkable time for water. We put in place a modern water system, and everyone here has benefited from that in ways that we don't fully understand and appreciate. But we're in a transition again, I'm going to argue, and I could give a long talk about this, but it's a technology transition, it's an institutional transition, it's a legal transition, it's an economic transition, in some ways it's a philosophical transition. And so let's think for a minute about Flint and Toledo and Elk River, the disaster at Charleston, West Virginia. Those were three very high-profile examples where our drinking water systems sort of failed us for different reasons. And a lot of you covered this, and Tom did an unbelievable job in Toledo. And the media did a great job on these. And they were all a little bit different. So Charleston, oh, my God, we put tanks with horrible coal processing chemicals on the banks of a river upstream of a water intake. And the tank leaked in hindsight, that was pretty stupid. But there was a technological failure, and it was a monitoring failure, and it was an institutional failure, I mean, that led us from a regulatory perspective do that kind of a thing. And that's what happened in the Elk River. Flint, other people have talked about, Joe mentioned, it was a technology problem. We changed water sources. We didn't monitor properly. It was an economic failure. This is a poor community. There's a serious economic environmental justice problem associated with the Flint disaster. It was an institutional problem because of the way the state and the feds and the local agencies interacted, but it highlighted the vulnerability of our drinking water systems, where we have great technology in theory, but in practice, our institutions and the technologies we put in place maybe aren't adequate to the challenges of the 21st century. And Toledo, different problem. Climate change is affecting the Great Lakes. You know, we sort of cleaned up the Great Lakes with the Clean Water Act and the Safe Drinking Water Act. We put in place these modern technologies, but now the waters are warming up. We haven't dealt with non-point source pollution. Algae is growing. The water treatment systems aren't necessarily designed for that. There are these new challenges. And again, there were some institutional and some regulatory problems. So I say we're in a transition. I think there are two futures we can envision, a good one and a bad one. And the bad one is that we don't get our act together in the 21st century, that we don't make the investments in infrastructure that we need to make to upgrade and maintain the infrastructure that we built 100 years ago. And we see that every day. We see the leaky pipes. We see the treatment systems that are designed for X and Y pollutants and Z pollutants are coming along, and they're not adequate because there are new pollutants that are not adequately regulated, that we don't make the investment in the technology. And that can lead to inequities, environmental justice issues, a two-class water system where the rich put in place point-of-use filters and the poor get stuck with drinking what comes out of the taps. Where we have a continued regulatory failure to update the Clean Water Act and the Safe Drinking Water Act and the Toxic Control Substances Act, the things that protect our water systems, that we don't update them for the 21st century pollutants, for the new regulatory tools that we think work better than the ones we put in place 40 or 50 years ago, where people decide, all right, I'll buy bottled water because I don't trust my tap water. So that's a possible future, and sort of we're heading in that direction now. The other future is we get our act together in a systematic way, and we move toward what I've described as the soft path for water. We move toward a 21st century water system where we put in place the technology to deal with pollutants. We put in place the monitoring systems and the data systems so that we know what's happening in real time. We reinvest in distribution systems. We balance supply and demand in new ways, and I can talk more about that. We deal with economics in a proper way, and Laurel will maybe talk about some of this. There is a legal human right to water. The UN declared a human right to water legally in 2010, and California's passed a law on the human right to water, but we haven't quite figured out what that means from a community perspective, from a pricing perspective. What's a fair price for people to pay for water? How should we deal with subsidies on the agricultural side? I mean, there are a lot of economic questions, but there are strategies from the economic side to deal with sustainable management. And what are the institutions that we want to put in place for a smart 21st century water system? And those, again, Joe mentioned, but you probably didn't, if you weren't focused on it, it was sort of a throwaway. We have 55,000 water systems in the United States. Setting aside all those people who are not on water systems at all, but dependent on rural systems, what kind of effective institutions do we need in the 21st century to manage water better than we manage it now? Do we need a smaller number of systems? Do we need not just water systems, but water and energy systems integrated? You know, right now we have energy utilities and we have water utilities, but there are really strong links between energy and water. And if we manage them together, there's some benefits to doing that. But we haven't quite figured that out. So we're in a transition. I think we can design and imagine and sort of see pieces of a truly sustainable 21st century water system that are technological and economic and institutional and political and legal. But we're at this point where choices we make today are going to determine the kind of water system we have in the future. And it's not clear to me that the public fully understands this. It's not clear to me our politicians get this. The level of discourse, the public discourse around water is pretty limited, in part because I think there's not a great understanding of how important it is and that we're at this crossroad. So I'm going to stop there, and I'd be happy to talk in more detail about any pieces of this, depending on what you're interested in. Thanks.
Thanks Peter. Thomas, why don't you tell us what the impact of groundwater and what we should be looking for in stories about groundwater.
All right. Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Tom, for having me on this panel. I'm honored to be here. I'm a cooperative extension specialist and professor at the University of California in Davis. My background is I'm a hydrologist. I focus on groundwater. And being in cooperative extension and essentially being as a cooperative extension faculty, being a technology transfer agent and an outreach agent, I have really enjoyed working with many of you primarily through Kat Curlin at UC Davis, through our media office. And it's been, for me, a great learning process in trying to translate what we're doing on the research side into something that people really understand. So I figure I'll drill down a little bit more into the big water story, pun intended. there's sort of a handful of takeaway points that I wanted to make, and I'm going to summarize them first before going down into it. My first message, take-home message, would be if you think that most of our drinking water comes from almost all of our drinking water or a large part of our drinking water comes from surface water, think again. If you think that the Safe Drinking Water Act and the Clean Water Act protects most of our drinking water sources, think again. And if you think that this water story is just about drinking water, think about all the food that you're eating. So the bottom line is it's about groundwater. The groundwater is a very big piece in this, and I say that neither to be pity as a hydrogeologist, because everything seems to be about surface water. This is, I think, I want to just compliment the story. I don't want to minimize the surface water part, but I also want to point out that this is partly because it's groundwater, but we see the same thing with surface water. This is a really complex story. It's what social scientists call a wicked problem, and there's no easy answers in the way maybe the engineering systems we invented in the 19th century that were very quickly able to grasp, get around a very big problem. I think this revolution that Peter talks about, I agree with you, Peter, that we're at the edge of something new. But I think this new piece is going to be, how do we deal with a very complex issue that goes beyond just engineering? So just to kind of further highlight these points. Groundwater as a source of drinking water in California, it's almost half of our drinking water. When we go into a drought, it's more than half of our drinking water, almost two-thirds of our drinking water. Across the country, it is more than one-third of the drinking water comes from groundwater. Importantly, we talked about there's 157,000 systems that are regulated under the Safe Drinking Water Act. That does not include about 15 million private domestic wells. And those private domestic wells are mostly located in rural and in agricultural areas. And the Safe Drinking Water Act does not reach out to these private domestic wells. And these are all on groundwater. This is about 40 to 50 million people in the U.S. that are using groundwater as their drinking water through domestic wells, which are unregulated by the Safe Drinking Water Act. groundwater is an important drinking water resource, also because it's a relatively cheap source of water. Groundwater is typically served minimally treated, usually just chlorinated, whereas surface water needs significant treatment. In the context of modern terrorism, groundwater is a lot harder to get to than some of our surface water infrastructure, and is much better protected. There are a lot of urban areas that are thinking about, if they're on surface water, they're thinking about groundwater as at least as a backup system. To the point of groundwater not being protected, or your drinking water that's from groundwater not being protected by either the Clean Water Act or the Safe Drinking Water Act. What I mean by that is the Clean Water Act fundamentally focuses on surface water. It focuses on discharges to surface water from point sources through the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, the so-called NPDES permits that everybody who has a pipe going into a stream or a lake has to obtain. Most wastewater treatment plants have to get an NPDES permit to discharge into streams. And it does that through the so-called Total Maximum Daily Load Program, the TMDL program, which is one of the ways by which the Clean Water Act gets to non-point sources, mostly agricultural sources and stormwater runoff, that's polluting our streams, that's not associated with a pipe. But again, it's focused on surface water sources. There's no discharge permit that you need to obtain under the Clean Water Act to discharge into groundwater. Now, groundwater is protected by other acts. We have the Toxic Substances Control Act, which regulates industrial chemicals and how they're handled and disposed of. We have the Resource Conservation Recovery Act, which handles how we design landfills. We have the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, which handles how we deal with pesticides, what pesticides can be sold, and how they need to be handled and disposed of. So there are a lot of good things that we have done to protect groundwater resources. We also have Superfund, which provides a revolving fund and a mechanism to clean up contaminated groundwater where it's contaminated by industrial pollutants at local sites. The loophole in the federal legislation is with the one largest man-made contaminant in U.S. groundwater, and that is fertilizer. Nitrate from fertilizer and from animal production primarily, but also from urban wastewater and from septic system, is by far the most common pollutant in groundwater. In a recent USGS survey of domestic well water in the United States, the average contamination rate of domestic wells with contamination above the drinking water level was, I think the rate was 8%. But when they focus just on domestic wells in intensive agricultural regions, the contamination rate in intensive agricultural regions was 1 out of 4 domestic wells. We've done a study here in California, which has been replicated now several times and expanded. In some of the most intensively agriculturally farmed counties in the Central Valley, 4 out of 10 domestic wells have nitrate above the drinking water limit. From the federal side, the Clean Water Act doesn't reach in there. And the Safe Drinking Water Act, while it regulates the treatment and what's delivered in public water supply system to the customer, and while it regulates that the water systems educate themselves about potential dangers to their water quality in their source water area, it does not really reach back to the polluter in ways that would allow a water system to protect itself from a polluter through regulatory mechanisms. The other piece where the federal government is not really engaged in is what Peter referred to earlier. With the drought, we have seen that a lot of public and private water supply systems are very vulnerable to the vanishing groundwater resources. Wells are going dry. Private domestic wells are going dry, and that's another major threat to our drinking water supply. With that said, welcome to California, where things are a little bit different, right? California differs from the federal state in several ways. We are in the middle of a groundwater revolution, and more specifically, I think we're in the middle of an agricultural groundwater revolution, which brings me to the third point about this is not just about our drinking water, this is also about the food that we eat. California is the largest agricultural economy in the country, even though it is less than 5% of the California economy itself, which makes some folks think maybe agriculture should just go away. Maybe it should go into the California sunset, which, by the way, is Asia, if you look from here. And so I'd say, well, think about this again. Do we want to move all of our agriculture to Asia? The bigger picture here is in thinking about that is that it's not about agriculture in California. It's really about global agriculture. And this kind of points to the problems we face here in California, and if we face in the U.S., really being global problems, especially on the groundwater side. Irrigated agricultural lands like we have here in California occupy about 20% of all agricultural lands in the world, but they produce 40%, almost half, of all agricultural products. So irrigated agricultural regions like those in California play a very fundamental role in food production, food feed fiber, and biofuel production. To argue that California shouldn't be doing this agricultural business would be arguing that irrigated agriculture shouldn't be part of our food production system. Agriculture and irrigation is also the largest water user. Irrigation uses 70% of all global water supplies. In California, it's 80% of our California water supply consumption, not including environmental flows, is used by agriculture. But if you look at the actual consumptive use, the part of the water that gets evaporated and transpired into the air, globally it's 90% of water use, whereas drinking water is about 10%. Now, as I said, half of our drinking water is from groundwater. Globally, almost over 40% of irrigation water is from groundwater. And importantly, it is an insurance. Groundwater is the insurance that allows agriculture that depends on surface water for irrigation to continue when there's a dry season, a drought, climate variability, or climate change. It's an important insurance, and it's a big factor in global food security. So in California, we're at a place where we're at the cutting edge of trying to address all of these issues. We have a Clean Water Act version called the Puerto Colon Water Quality Act that covers groundwater and not just surface water. We have gotten to the point where we decided to regulate discharges into groundwater, including those from agricultural sources. We have come up with a Sustainable Groundwater Management Act in 2014, trying to address the overdraft of groundwater. And we're learning, we're in the middle of a continuing process that's not going to be over anytime soon of learning important lessons on how to go about it. And the one last point I wanted to make in terms of how this revolution that Peter spoke to, that is happening and how we're dealing with water resources may look like, I think California is an excellent place to look at how this is being done. What I'm seeing in this process as we're getting engaged in California, Laurel, Peter, others, in dealing with nitrate pollution of groundwater, groundwater overdraft, the Delta issue, looking at groundwater in a more comprehensive way. It's the integration of dealing with groundwater issues, drinking water issues, surface water issues, integrating supply issues with water quality issues, integrating the engineering solutions with the social engagement, the empowerment of our disadvantaged communities, the empowerment of our minorities from the ground up. It's these very integrated solutions that are not easy to come by because they need a lot of capacity building, They need a lot of education, they need a lot of facilitation and learning, and they take a lot of time and engagement that I think are going to make up part of this 21st century water revolution, and not just in California.
Good.
Thank you.
Let's stop. Thanks, Tom. And Laurel, why don't you give us your perspective on why this all matters and what your group does to try to get that message
Great.
Across.
Thank you. Getting over a cold, so hopefully my voice holds up. So we just celebrated our 10th anniversary for our organization, and that gives me a little time to, you know, it gives you a moment to reflect and think back and remember 10 years ago when we were contacted by a group of mothers whose water was coming out brown. It smelled like sewage. They weren't getting answers as to what was happening. They were concerned about what their kids were getting served at school. We met women like Maria Elena, who was trying to take care of her children, her elderly mother, and figure out how she could have she could get rides to go fill up 5-gallon jugs, lug them back to her house, and make sure that there was safe drinking water for her kids and aging parents. And this was going on 10 years ago. It's unfortunately still going on today. There's more than 4 times the number of people in Flint that in California that don't have safe drinking water on a regular basis, and many of them haven't for over a decade. At this point, going on 2 decades. In the drought, we saw this much exacerbated. We had families, there were thousands of households whose private wells, their individual domestic wells, went dry. There was some really good coverage of that, but I think still not enough. I mean, I think we oftentimes with things like the drought, we focus on this as in the instant issue, but this is something that was frankly was going on many years before, was just further exacerbated, and also will take a lot of very difficult decisions at local and state levels to fundamentally address and change. But, you know, talking to families who had 6-month-old babies, they were trying to figure out how to bathe, how to do laundry, how to be able to flush the toilet, and having to go borrow buckets of water to flush the toilet, wash dishes from their neighbors. Talking to people that have lived for over 2 years without running water in their houses, it definitely puts a different perspective on these issues and I think urgency. These are issues that have occur in nearly every county within the state of California and much of the country. It's not California alone. But they are disproportionately in high poverty communities and communities of color, especially in here in California and the San Joaquin Valley. So the majority of communities without safe drinking water that are regulated even under the Safe Drinking Water Act are within the San Joaquin Valley, which is this agricultural region just south of here. So in 2012... our organization does organizing, advocacy, and education with communities that are directly impacted by lack of access to safe, clean, affordable drinking water. And in 2012, we were successful in passing and getting signed the Human Right to Water in California, which is the first of its kind. And, you know, in some ways, to us, that was finally a recognition that everyone deserves access to safe, clean, affordable drinking water, that this is a basic human right, that we're not asking for something crazy here, and that this has to be built in to all of the decision-making that happens at the state level, whether it's grants, whether it's regulating agriculture, whether it's looking at at the different water management and spending decisions that are made. And I think it's definitely starting to. We've seen some real fundamental changes in the past 10 years. We've seen agriculture have regulations of groundwater for nitrate for both dairies and irrigated agriculture. So now every dairy in at least in the Central Valley irrigated agriculture needs to do nutrient management plans and actually look at the amount of contamination from nitrate and fertilizers that's leaching into groundwater. And there's new powers that have been enacted around consolidation and addressing economies of scale. So when you look at those systems that don't have access to safe drinking water for years and years, it's really all very small systems that don't have technical, managerial, or financial capacity to institute and run very expensive treatment systems for things like arsenic and nitrate. And I think, you know, reinforcing some of the things that were said by other speakers, that's something that's going to continue to transform the way that we provide drinking water, I think, in the state and throughout the country, is how are we building the economies of scales to make sure that we're more resilient and can provide affordable and reliable drinking water supplies. And part of that is creating shared solutions. I think the history of this country has been one where we've kept low-income communities and communities of color outside of cities, outside of infrastructure. There was some very deliberate and explicit zoning that did that many, you know, years ago. There's continued patterns now, and we have a long way to go to start to correct that and build systems that are truly equitable and can provide safe, clean, and affordable drinking water, even with things like continued droughts and climate change. One thing I wanted to mention is, one of the things California just published a proposal to start regulating a contaminant that's 1,2,3 TCP trichloropropane. And I think this is another example where, you know, when we talk with communities, even once they've been able to get treatment into place, and they want to know, is my water safe? And the difficulty with that is that our drinking water system is, it has public health goals and it has MCLs and it has contaminants that haven't made it through the regulatory process yet. And so 1,2,3 TCP is an example of that. It's extremely potent carcinogen. And one that is found in a huge number of public water supplies, especially in agricultural areas in the state and much of the West. It was a contaminant of pesticides that were used in the 80s and discontinued, manufactured by Shell and Dow. And even though they're no longer used, it continues to contaminate our water supplies and is served to many customers and doesn't have a drinking water standard. And so it isn't, you know, people don't have to be notified. And there isn't a safe level set yet. So for years, you know, we knew about this. I think the state had established a public health standard and hadn't taken the next step to develop an MCL. This is true for many things at the federal level too. And finally, the state is in the process of establishing an MCL for 1,2,3 TCP. For those of us that work with residents and live in places that, you know, want to be able to drink water and know whether your water is safe, even if we know something like 1,2,3 TCP, even for somebody like me that, you know, this was part of my job, I'd research this. When I looked at what we could do living in the community and what could be done, there's no certified filters for 1,2,3 TCP because it's not regulated yet. And so the certification programs don't do certification until there's a limit set so that they can have a goal. And so the you know, I think it's, there's, although the system is, you know, the vast majority of people have safe drinking water from their tap, there's also just so much that we don't know and that we're not doing. And there's so many people that are dropping, that for whom the system isn't working. And I think that have been really invisible or even deliberately excluded from systems. And so, you know, I think we still have a long way to go. We've made a huge amount of progress. I think we have unprecedented new laws to start to get a handle on things, but we're going to have to do a whole lot more. So thanks.
Great.
Questions per SEJ policy. Working journalist first, and please identify yourself. Go ahead.
Hi there. My name is Nate Selfridge. I'm a freelancer in the Bay Area. Thank you guys so much for sharing all that information up front. I don't believe I heard mention of arsenic, but I just wanted to ask, as I understand, that's somewhat of a significant issue in the U.S. still as far as regulation and treatment within small systems and especially for folks on private wells. So I just wanted to see if that kind of basic impression is accurate to your guys' experience and how we're doing as far as treatment and policy.
The question is about arsenic. I'm repeating some of these questions into the microphone because we're recording, but if people want to weigh in on arsenic, go ahead, Laurel.
Yeah, so the number one, right now, the number one contaminant of drinking water systems is arsenic, which is primarily naturally occurring, not entirely. But it's also interesting because there's been a pattern where, you know, nitrate has been regulated for a long time. The MCL hasn't changed. And so many systems, and it's an acute contaminant, so many systems had to shut down their nitrate wells and they drilled deeper in order to avoid the nitrate that was really from from agriculture and human and other sources. And so they went deeper into the aquifer, and that's where there's naturally occurring arsenic. And so it's actually still linked, I think, to many of the pollution challenges that we have, even though it's naturally occurring. In most areas, it can also be caused from other sources. I think it's also, so it's a real challenge, especially for small communities, because the treatment is extremely expensive, mostly the operation and maintenance. And so when we look at our finance system, you know, we have options for financing capital improvements. There's still a long way to go in that, but in California in particular, we really try and make that prioritize small systems. But small systems can't afford to operate these treatment plants without the economy of scale to be able to afford those costs. And there's no subsidies or finance systems out there for operation and maintenance. It's all on ratepayers. So that really leads to either very unaffordable rates or what most systems have done, small systems have done, is just not put something in place because they know they can't afford to operate it. And then there's some horror stories like Lanier where they actually put it in place. They got $1 million treatment plant. They couldn't afford to operate it. They went into $120,000 or so in debt and had to mothball the plant. They now have unsafe drinking water, and their system is in receivership, and they're paying, you know, extremely high rates to for water that they still can't drink now. So it's a real challenge. I think it goes to this issue of how do we create economies of scale? How do we create shared systems that? And also, I think as a state, we're going to have, and this is true of other states as well, but we need to figure out how we address the affordability issue, especially for small systems. And you know, in other sectors like energy or telecommunications, there's a lifeline rate for a basic service. There should be something like that for a basic amount of water, and that's going to take some subsidizing, which will be a major financial shift for for certainly the state and others.
Okay, Joe, you want to add? Just some add-on. Arsenic's a problem in small communities. It is difficult to treat, but there actually is an approach that can be used, and that's decentralized treatment. Instead of building a central plant, you put a small treatment unit in each home and you manage it centrally. We did a demonstration project on that in Grimes, California, up the road from here. Worked great. Cost was half of what a central treatment plant would have cost. And it's a novel way of providing safe drinking water in a small community using a decentralized mode rather than a centralized mode. So the water was coming in from the central plant, but it was treated for arsenic in the home. And a contractor then did the replacement of cartridges and all that, and it worked extremely well. It's all there in writing, how to do it.
Next question. John?
Yes. John Aston, I write for a meeting at Alliance. About half my writing is about energy, so I'm on a broad scale interested in how from extraction to power plant impact on water, in particular fracking.
Good. Yeah, so there are lots of threats to our water systems. We sort of touched on a bunch of them. The Pacific Institute completed about a year ago with the California Council on Science and Technology for the state of California an assessment of broadly the risks from fracking and maybe even more broadly from enhanced oil and gas production. There's a major section on water that the Institute wrote. There's a seismic section, there's a air quality section, there's a community section on that. So if you go to the California Council on Science and Technology website, you can find that. More broadly than fracking, let me talk about oil and gas production in general, because fracking is a subset of oil and gas production. There are very significant water-related risks. A lot of the attention has been on how much water it takes to frack a well, and that's not the big issue. That's an issue sometimes, especially in water-scarce areas, but the really big issue is the very large amount of water that's produced with oil and gas production. You drill a well, you get oil or gas, and it turns out you get a lot of water. Sometimes you get, for every barrel of oil you get 10 barrels of what's called produced water. And this oil and gas wastewater, whether it's from a fracked well or a regular traditional oil and gas well, has to be dealt with. And typically what we do, the oil and gas industry, or we society, is we reinject it. We dump it back, we pump it back down into groundwater. And this raises all sorts of groundwater quality protections. It raises the seismic issue in Oklahoma. The seismic problem in Oklahoma is from reinjected oil and gas wastewater. It's not from the fracking process itself. It's typically from reinjection. The threats to groundwater from reinjection are you drill these wells that goes through groundwater systems that sometimes we want to use. And so that's the big concern. The other thing we do with this wastewater, and if you can believe it, in the 21st century, is we dump very large volumes of it into unlined surface pits in California. There are 900 or so largely unregulated surface pits that are unlined, and we dump this wastewater in, and that is a groundwater contamination problem. Laurel talked about, and Tom talked about, the nitrate problem that we get with fertilizers going into groundwater. Well, when you dump oil and gas wastewater onto the ground and let it evaporate off, you lose a lot of that into groundwater as well. And so there's an effort now to shut a lot of those surface pits down, to regulate them better. But there are a broad set of threats to water resources, surface water and groundwater, from oil and gas operations broadly.
Okay, we got time.
Well, the concept contaminants of emerging concern is a rather open-ended one. So the question is, what are they? What are the concentrations? What are the exposures? What are the risks? And, of course, it's a very, very broad spectrum. I'll talk about pharmaceuticals, for example. The issue on pharmaceuticals is wastewater, which people who have swallowed pharmaceuticals and also who produce, you know, estrogens and such, and then gets discharged into the waste stream, goes to the wastewater treatment plant. Not all of it is removed at the wastewater treatment plant. There has been a lot of analysis of what's the significance, what's the risk, and so forth. And I can tell you, World Health Organization, for example, concluded worldwide that it wasn't a significant risk for drinking water. Now, I disagree with that because I think there are places in the world where it is a significant risk because they don't do wastewater treatment, so they're not removing anything. And so you're getting wastewater in, and then it comes out at the other end. In the United States, however, we do have pretty good wastewater treatment. The issue on those, pharmaceuticals and endocrines, really is in the river. It's the wildlife, the animals, the fish in the river who are getting the highest exposures. And so from a conceptual way, and if you can manage, do a better job of wastewater treatment, you reduce the loads in the river, you automatically reduce the loads getting to the drinking water plant. So my sort of legal philosophical approach to this is do a better job of wastewater treatment, and then you'll protect not only the environment but also the drinking water. Don't put the load on the drinking water people to spend the money to take out that last nanogram, that last part per trillion of what we're talking about.
Can I say something about this? Because, Jim, partly you were asking, is the regulatory system able to deal with these things? The answer to that is, the evidence for that at the moment is no. Our absolute inability to get new standards through the EPA Congressional Safe Drinking Water Act process is abysmal. The number of new contaminants that have been added to the regulatory system is effectively zero for 20 years. There's one perchlorate there's not an official standard. There's a standard, but it's not a clean water. It's not a Safe Drinking Water Act standard. And there are so many of these things. You know, maybe we can get another one for some new thing, but there are thousands of chemicals out there that are not regulated. And I think the Joe's response in part I actually agree with, in the sense that don't expect the regulatory system to deal with these things, because we don't seem to be able to make it do that. And Congress has shown no interest in updating the Safe Drinking Water Act or the Clean Water Act. And I'm not a technological optimist normally, but I do think we have the ability to remove anything we want from water, to produce any quality water that we want. And so part of this transition that I talked about at the beginning is a technical one. If we upgrade our infrastructure to put in place the modern treatment systems that can treat wastewater or treat drinking water, independent of what the regulations require, we can produce drinking water that's incredibly safe and pure. And so I argue we do need these technological advances. I would love to see some regulatory and institutional improvements, but it's going to have to be a mix of all of those things.
I think the Safe Drinking Water Act is pretty good in terms of the authorities. I think EPA has done a bad job of implementing it in the last 10 or 20 years, as Peter says, and we can talk about some specific examples. It isn't that hard to regulate something once you can make the case. The Safe Drinking Water Act spells out what the criteria are. Number one, the substance needs to be toxic, hazardous. Number two, it needs to be relatively widely distributed at levels of concern. In other words, not in one state, not in one river, but widely distributed. Number three, in the administrator's judgment, the regulation should result in health benefits, reduce risk, okay? Number one and number three are kind of superfluous. The real question is number two, widespread distribution at levels of concern. There aren't very many substances that meet that definition. And what that means is it's a state's responsibility, if you have a particular contaminant in your region, in your state, don't expect the federal government's going to regulate it if it's not a relatively universal contaminant. We do have a federal system here. States do have responsibilities and authorities. So if it's not a national issue, it's the responsibility of one or two or three states to deal with it. So the system's there. EPA has not functioned very well with the authorities that it has, but the states need to pick up the ball, too.
Yeah, so the question was PFOS, what is the latest on those chemicals and concerns around drinking water? I actually was just going to say that I've had the same questions. And I think, you know, I used to live in the Central Valley in a little community that there was fire suppression and chemicals all the time around dropped on the water supply in the watershed that ultimately goes directly into the drinking water system there. And I haven't, you know, even in those communities, all of the local engineers and water systems have just totally no idea. Nobody's monitoring for it. Nobody knows, is even thinking about it. And so people have basically said it's not an issue, but provided no information on it. And that's been my experience. But I don't know. It's a question I've had.
National distribution of PFOA, PFOS in drinking water. Turns out it's very limited, very small, very localized. If you have a plant over here that manufactures it and has been dumping it, such as has been the case in southern Ohio, you would have exposures there. But it turns out on a national scale, drinking waters actually have quite negligible amounts. It's like 0.4% of the water supplies that were measured out of 4,000 exceeded a trigger level. The primary exposure to PFOA, PFOS is Scotchgard, was Scotchgard. It has since been banned to use different substances. The amount of PFOA, PFOS in human blood has been declining precipitously. In the year 2000, it was around 100% of blood samples taken had detectable one of those. Now it's getting down to about 50%. And so drinking water generally is not a significant source. And that's why it's not regulated nationally.
Karen?
So I've talked a little bit about money, and Laurel mentioned, I mean, there are a lot of pieces to the economic component. One is affordability and the equity issue around safe water. Another is the investment required, and that we didn't talk much about that. There's billions of dollars of massive underinvestment in this country in infrastructure across the board, not just water, but all sorts of things. Having said that, there's plenty of money, I believe, to fix these problems. I don't think the cost of fixing these problems is anywhere close to the cost to us of failing to fix these problems. And we don't think about it in that sense. But what is the cost to the United States of not having safe drinking water? What's the social cost of having a two-class system where the rich put in point-of-use filters and drink bottled water, and the poor don't no longer have access to safe tap water? We can't afford that, I would argue. There are also substantial revenue sources. We pay for water. Most of us, we mostly pay less for our water than we ought to be paying to maintain the infrastructure, with the very important caveat that Laurel has raised and I raised earlier, that poorer communities are paying too much for water, and there ought to be systems put in place for these cross subsidies the way we do for energy or for telecommunications or some of our other basic infrastructure. But there are ways of replacing pipes now that are inexpensive. We have 100-year-old pipes. They're still digging up wooden pipes in Philadelphia and New York. It's ridiculous that we're not investing the money that we ought to maintain the water system. So, you know, it's a lot of money on the one hand, but it's not a lot of money in reality.
Yeah, I just wanted to add real quickly, one thing, you know, that I've covered with the Toledo water crisis is not just the hard costs, but the perception and what it does to a community. In Toledo, you know, we're battling not only the crisis, but you know, the fallout, and was that a one-time crisis? Is it a chronic fear? You know, the following summer, we had just the appearance of algae. It was all over TV, all over the newspapers, and people were clearing out supermarket shelves, and there was no real high toxin, high
high threat there. And one of the better received stories I did was on the one-year anniversary about the marketing and branding efforts of Toledo and other communities when you've been injured with the with a crisis. And there was some research done by this at Marquette University following the Cryptosporidium disaster in 1993 in Milwaukee, what it did to some of their marketing and branding efforts, perceptions that lingered. And in Toledo, for example, the Toledo Lucas County Health Department did a survey five weeks after the crisis and found a vast majority of, 70-80% of the people still weren't regularly drinking the tap water because they just didn't trust it. And so, it gets down to you're not only, and I had long talks about this with our former mayor and some of the economic development folks. We've had people show up at conferences. Somebody said they had a Fortune 500 executive come to town. He looked around Toledo, some of the struggles downtown with the vacant buildings, and in the back of his mind, he remembered the water crisis, and he turned around, didn't even go to his interview, and just said, "I just can't do it." And so, what does that do to the lingering perceptions of your community? Because perception can be stronger than reality, as we know with a lot of things. So,
I just have one thing. You've hit the nail on the head. Infrastructure is the problem. And think about it. You can take spring water, put it in the tap, put it in the distribution system. When it comes out at your tap, it's not spring water anymore. It's picked up a lot of contamination from the pipes, and this is reality. And so, unless you're going to spend $500 billion to really remake those 100-year-old distribution systems, you've got a fundamental problem that will go on forever. The second principal remaining issue in drinking water safety is biofilms in plumbing systems, which produce Legionella and other organisms, which are the most significant public health risks today. They actually kill people. Number one. Number two, I'm not that concerned about one part per trillion of, chemical X.
Well, with that, I think we're done. And thanks for attending. I think we'll just end it there. Thanks.